today, growing up in the shadow of America's darkest day and in the media spotlight.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
Do you remember where you were on 9/11? For many who are old enough, the day is a kind of bookmark, before and after. This week is 20 years since that attack. And over the next days, we're going to look at some of the consequences of a catastrophe that cost the lives of nearly 3,000 people and transformed millions of others. We're starting with those it hit hardest, a group who always feel this time of year coming.
A lot of the time I grew up saying, oh, I hate September. Everything bad happens in September. Like, it was just kind of a bad month for me in general because of how it just made everything so dismal.
I always think that in the week leading up to 9/11, I'm never feeling like my normal self. Just anticipating that day is stressful in of itself.
I know this year is 20 years, so it's, to some, it may be a milestone or a significant year. For me, it's no different than any other year.
Whether they wanted to or not, they've become known as the 9/11 kids, those who went through the devastating private loss of a parent in attacks that everybody else feels they experienced too.
They expect this grieving little girl who's so heartbroken, but I'm almost 20 years old. It does hurt me every day when I think about, oh yeah, he won't be there at my wedding or he won't be there for those big things, but I know he loves me and it's not something that dawns on me every single day. I'm grown up now.
This story's about becoming famous for the worst reason, in some cases before you were even born, and carrying the weight of grief, even after the media has moved on. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, the children of 9/11, 20 years on. Ed Pilkington, you're chief reporter with Guardian US, and we're approaching the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks. Four planes hijacked on a Tuesday morning by Al-Qaeda terrorists.
Nobody moves. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any moves...
Two were used to strike the World Trade Center towers in New York. Another the Pentagon. And a fourth, potentially targeting the US Capitol building, heroically brought down by its passengers over a field in Pennsylvania.
United 93, have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
When did he land?
He did not land.
The death toll, 2,977 people. We're all pretty familiar with what happened that day, but what I find hard to remember is how it felt at the time, the mood. How do you remember it?
Well, it's very hard for me to actually put into words the feeling of that day, particularly as I was foreign editor of The Guardian based in London at the time. Shell shock almost, a slight feeling of paralysis at a time when you had to work harder than any time in your entire life. And we all went into hyperdrive, and it wasn't just the events of that day. The events of that day led then into a complete global change. It led to the wars in Afghanistan, it led to the wars in Iraq, and it just led to an enormous sea of human tragedy. Everything changed in that moment.
It's amazing that we all feel some stake in an event like this, one that is televised globally. We all feel that we lived through in some way. But for a number of families in the US, the significance and impact of the event was much more personal, and you've been speaking to some of those people. I wondered if you could start by telling me about Mike and Dan Friedman. Who are they and what do they remember of that day?
Mike and Dan are twins, and I actually got to meet them this summer at a Mets ball game where several of the children of 9/11, in other words, people who lost a parent on that day, were brought together by a charity called Tuesday's Children. And like anyone else who's ever met them, I was astonished by how tall they are. Mike is 6 foot 11 inches and Dan is 6 foot 9 inches. And actually, well before 9/11, they had been given a nickname. They'd gone to this event with the superstar basketball player Magic Johnson through their mother. And they'd actually got to meet him and they got to ask for an autograph. And Magic Johnson looked at the two twins standing before him, you know, rising even at a young age, way up. And he wrote on the picture, "To the Twin Towers, good luck, Magic Johnson."
You are kidding. That's the nickname?
I'm not kidding. And as a result, the nickname stuck. And from then on, they were then called the Twin Towers.
We were well behaved. We really committed ourselves to academics. Maybe me a little more so than Mike, but you know.
Wow.
As he's looking at me like that.
Mike, you agree with that?
I don't agree with that at all. What I will say is that it was a normal household, normal way of life. And it was that way until, unfortunately, September 11th.
So when I asked the brothers to describe the events of that fateful day, they took me back to the night before. Their father was a huge sports fan.
We very much remember him getting angry at the television because the New York Giants were losing to the Denver Broncos. And we remember he would sit at the couch with his big bottle of Coca-Cola and his chicken wings and scream at the television. But that was him.
And that was one of the perfect last memories they have of him. And then the next day, off they went to school. And on that morning, the principal came into their two separate classrooms and ushered them out and said that he wanted them to know that a plane had crashed into one of the Twin Towers where their father was working. But he was going to be okay, that he had plenty of air and it was all going to be okay. That's what they were told.
When did they learn otherwise?
The adults in their lives, in the first instance, their instinct was to shield them from any information. So they were taken out of school. They went to a neighbor's house who had a swimming pool. They remember having a great time. They had a barbecue that night. They were kind of being spoiled and they didn't know why, but they just kind of enjoyed it. It was not until the following day that their mother took them aside.
And then our mom... And this was the toughest part, when she sat us down and she basically said to us, "Guys, I don't think your dad's coming back."
Do we know how many kids there were, like Mike and Dan, who lost parents in the attacks?
Yes, a figure of 3,051 children has been put to this, the children who lost a parent, to which I'd add a couple of other things. One, that most of them lost a father, because it's one of the facts of 9/11 that 7 out of the 8 of the almost 3,000 victims of that day were male. And I think that figure of 3,051, it speaks to the booming tragedy of 9/11, which went so, so much farther than the individuals who lost their lives. It touched on so many thousands of other people, in this instance, the children.
And it touched another group that you've been looking at. And their relationship to the attacks is in some ways more complex. Who are they?
Yeah, a subgroup of the 3,000 or so children who lost a parent were the so-called babies of 9/11. And these were kids who had not actually been born on the day. They were still in the womb. And there were 105 of these kids who were born after 9/11 having lost their father on that day, which, again, I find a very astonishing figure. I spoke to one of those 105, a young woman who, by definition, is coming up to her 20th birthday. She was born on November the 3rd, 7 weeks after 9/11, called Robin Higley, who comes from Connecticut. And she's named after her father, Robert Higley, who everyone calls Robbie, though her mum, Vicky, calls him Rob.
My dad was her best friend. They met at a party one night. They sent love letters. They were each other's other halves.
Robbie Higley was working in the South Tower of the World Trade Center, the 92nd floor. So at 8:46, when the North Tower was the first to be hit, Robbie called his wife, Vicky.
So that morning, I was working, and he called me, and he said, "Something happened in the other building, and we're fine." It was an agonizingly short conversation when I look back at it now, obviously.
And that was the last conversation they had?
Yes, that was the last time they spoke. Vicky later learned through other people who'd been on the 92nd floor with him that he had lost his life because he'd been trying to help others. On that morning, he'd been made the acting day manager of his office. He worked as an insurance executive. And he had ushered 12 of his colleagues into an elevator. Robbie decided not to get in the elevator. He put his colleagues in it, and then he decided to go back out and do a final sweep of the 92nd floor to make sure everyone was getting out.
And from what one of the women told us who was on that elevator, she said she wishes she had pulled him in and made him come with them because they were the last elevator to get out.
In that time he did that sweep, the South Tower collapsed, having been struck at 9:03 by United Airlines Flight 175.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to...
In the weeks that followed that attack, the world geared up for war. And I remember there was this enormous public appetite for revenge. But for these families, it must have been a time of intense grief. What do they remember of those days and weeks after September 11?
Well, I think the immediate story was one of not knowing. There was no confirmation of who had died. There was just missing people. And in the case of Mike and Dan, their mum took them out into Manhattan to take part in the really searing and awful scene that was going on for days after 9/11, which was that families were going around carrying flyers of their lost loved ones who they were praying and hoping were still alive. Maybe they were in a hospital somewhere. Bear in mind, it was chaos everywhere. There was still a pall of smoke over downtown Manhattan, and they recalled that they never even got a single call. And then the ultimate moment was when a couple of weeks after 9/11, the boys were asked to give the eulogy at their father's memorial.
And then having to give that speech, that's when it really hit me. Having to stand in front of upwards of 2,000 people and talk about our dad now knowing that he wasn't coming home, that's when it really hit me.
On Vicky's side, she was caring for her 4-year-old daughter, Amanda, and she was very, very heavily pregnant. Remember, Robin was born 7 weeks later. And I asked her, what did she remember about the immediate days after 9/11? And she was kind of incapable of telling me anything. She said she just went into survival mode. It's just like a black hole in her mind. She did reach out to local media. And of course, they were instantly taken by the fact that she was so heavily pregnant and thinking, wow, there's a baby about to be born who's just lost their father. That makes a story.
I wanted his story to be told. I talk to reporters every year, even after 20 years, because I want to keep his story alive.
So Robin, the daughter, finds this still to this day hilariously funny. But ABC's documentary show 2020 latched on and asked Vicky, the mother, whether they could make a documentary of her story leading up to the birth, to the extent that when Vicky went into labor and started to make arrangements to go to the hospital, she got there and found that the camera crew from 2020 had beaten her to it and were already in the delivery room setting up shop to film the birth.
Oh my God.
The news crews beat my mom to the delivery room. It was hilarious.
What, literally?
Yes, literally. And most of my family, my mom's cousins, my grandparents, everyone was there.
I mean, it was like being at the fun fair by the sound of it.
I was alone because I didn't have Rob, but I wasn't alone. Is kind of the way I explain it.
This is significant to the extent that Robin emerged a 9/11 baby. So she had the label pinned on her from the second she was born. But she was born a sort of 9/11 celebrity and has remained so pretty much ever since.
That scene, giving birth in front of cameras, sounds so intense, so overwhelming, given everything that Vicky must have been going through. It strikes me that this was a moment of intensely private loss and grief for that family, but actually it was intertwined with a moment of major national trauma. How does Vicky remember that period, the aftermath of her daughter's birth?
I think you put it very well. The story here is profound and intimate loss woven into a global, world-changing historical event and how the two clashed. And it's interesting when you talk to her that, and I think this was true of many, many 9/11 families, that really they had very little sense of what they should be doing, how to move forward, how to talk to the children about what had happened.
I still feel that today. There was nothing that I was given that said how to raise two young children who lost their father in this tragic thing, and they both had it on different levels.
And as a result, I think, again, I think this is true of a lot of 9/11 families, the decision they came to was to say very little. So that kids like Robin and Dan and Mike grew up in, at least for many years, really knowing very, very little about their own fathers and about what had happened to them and why it had happened to them.
I mean, these families were going through two very intense things at once. Obviously, the grief of losing a parent, but then also the stress of being in the glare of the media.
Yes, in the case of the Higley family, one of the most potent examples of that was the mutual jealousy felt between the two sisters. Remember, Amanda was four when 9/11 happened and her father died, and Robin had not yet been born. So you could say that Amanda was the one who dealt with the trauma. She was incredibly close to her father. So when he died, she felt very deep grief and despair. And yet it was the media's choice to focus on Robin, because Robin was the 9/11 baby. And it was a kind of weird thing for the media to do on one level. And, you know, let's be honest, we're doing the same thing. We're focusing on Robin. So we can't detach ourselves from that entirely. But Robin wasn't there on 9/11. She never met her father. Vicky describes how hard Amanda has found that over these years. She's felt real jealousy about it. And she's felt it's wrong. It's wrong for her younger sister, who wasn't around on 9/11, to get all the attention, and for her, Amanda, to get no attention at all.
Amanda and I are very, very close, but we also have a lot of resentment toward each other for different things.
Robin, in return, feels resentment of the 4 years that Amanda had with her father. And Robin has these kind of little details stuck in her mind that Robbie used to take Amanda to father-daughter dances.
He snuck her out of preschool to go buy waffles, and that's my favorite story of all time.
Those details clearly niggle with Robin, and she kind of gets stuck on them and starts thinking about, wow, her father loved Amanda, but he never knew her. And she's obviously found that extremely difficult over the years.
That must have been so difficult to be defined, at least in the media, by the loss of someone you've never actually met. But what about the twins, Mike and Dan?
So I think when for Robin, the years passing was about trying to wrestle with her own relationship to the father she hadn't met. For Mike and Dan, it was a different process. It was about starting to realize the enormity of 9/11. For many years after the event, they were focused tightly and exclusively on their own grief and on their relationship with the father that they'd lost. But over time, they came to see that they were not alone and that it was a vastly bigger event with vastly greater emotional consequences.
Understanding what had happened and the impact of it, it was heavy and it was sad. It was really sad that we're going to be part of something that's going to be lasting forever in a negative way, which is tough. Which is really tough.
So kids like Robin, Dan, and Mike, they have a huge spotlight, the nation's sympathy. What kind of support systems were put in place around them?
Well, being 9/11, being the kind of biggest world event in our lifetimes, you can imagine that there was a lot of official and governmental support given to families who lost people on the day. That included lump sum subsidies for families that helped them go on to lead comfortable lives. And also there was this summer camp called America's Camp. It was 1 week every summer. It was usually held in Massachusetts. And it brought together kids who'd lost a parent on 9/11.
We went water skiing, or we did gymnastics or knitting or all these fun things. And we danced around the lunchroom. And it was just a safe, fun place where we could be kids.
So in the aftermath of these attacks, Vicky, her daughters Amanda and Robin, and then Dan and Mike Friedman, they become celebrities of a kind. But even after an event this horrific, the US did move on. I'm wondering, after that immediate glow of fame subsided, what was life like for these kids who had to then live with this grief and this confusion?
As you say, I think over time, the grief that the kids felt became less a shared public experience, and it closed into becoming a more private thing. Robin remembers generally having to deal with anxiety and stress. She found it very, very difficult, and has done over the years, to sort of walk into buildings that she hasn't been to before. When she goes to the cinema, she asks her mother to go in before she does, to just check it's okay.
I think it's just because I grew up knowing that my dad walked into work one day and never walked out.
She's also described how over the years, you might call it a form of bullying, that may be too strong a word, but she has faced difficulty from other kids at school, particularly around the 9/11 anniversary period.
Even people who weren't my friends would come up and be like, hey, how you doing? Are you okay? And I'm just like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm just trying to get through school.
She found that very distressing. She didn't want to have to talk about that. She also had this spooky sense that people wanted her to break down. They wanted to see her burst into tears around the time of the anniversaries.
Every time an announcement would play and I would start tearing up a little bit, you would see all the eyes just gravitate towards me.
The kids also described to me different ways in which they've learned how to kind of feel better about what happened. And memorabilia are important, like having trinkets or possessions that their fathers had. One of the twins has a golf club that Andrew Friedman used to play golf with, and he keeps it in his locker at the club he now plays at, and says he will always do so, and that kind of comforts him. In Robin's case, she had a pink bunny bought for her by Robbie, her father, and he bought the pink bunny when they learned that the fetus in Vicky's womb was going to be a girl. And Robin describes that as hugely important to her because she'd been anxious that he didn't know her. You know, it's kind of weird because we think, well, she didn't know him. But what bothers her most is that he didn't know her. And the fact that he bought her a pink bunny tells her, well, he did know her. He knew that she was going to be a girl. He loved her even before she was born.
That gave me a little bit of comfort knowing, yeah, he knew about me. He knew who I was. Like, he was excited about me.
It's such a complex grief. I mean, I can't imagine what these kids must have gone through. You mentioned that as they grew up, the reaction of their parents was to shield them a little bit from the stories of their fathers. And I'm wondering, over the years, as the kids got older, did they try to fill those gaps to learn what actually had happened on that day?
Yes, I think that is a pattern that happens to a lot of these kids, and certainly to the people I spoke to. So for the Twin Towers of Mike and Dan, if you recall, they were left with the impression that their father, Andrew, had plenty of air. And that was a phrase that the principal had used when he pulled them out of their class on 9/11 itself. And so they were left with this idea that in the period of time, or an hour and a half or so before the collapse of the tower, that things had been okay. And it was only in their early 20s that their mother shared with them what had actually happened. And that was that the plane had hit the tower in such a way that the floor he was on was almost constricted.
There was a lot of smoke in the air. The walls were caving in. The stairwell was completely inaccessible. All the coughing, all the choking, people jumping out of the building.
It was basically an hour and a half, and excuse my language, it was an hour and a half of hell. And that was painful to hear.
So they had to get their head around that. Very, very difficult.
I mean, that is so terrible. It was such a horrific thing to learn about your father. As they set about learning more about their dads, the good stuff as well as the bad, did it make it easier somehow?
That's right. I think they started to build up a more rounded picture of their father and of 9/11. Over the years, they've talked to many, many of their father's friends. They described their father as the most sociable guy, had more friends than anyone in the world. And those friends shared lots of happy stories about his obsession with sport and how much They loved them, his children.
No matter where we are, it seems like we hear a new story. I feel like every week I learn something new about our dad that we didn't know. And we thought we knew our dad very, very well.
I think that has helped them over the years, A, know him better, but also feel better about his loss. And I think the same pattern happened for Robin.
I knew my mom had a hard time talking about him as a person because that was the love of her life. And she was so afraid to let go and to talk about it.
In the absence of her mother giving much information to her, she kind of filled in little holes by talking to her father Robbie's friends. And as a result, she gained a much broader and a much happier picture of her father.
So the little bits and pieces I know is that he was exactly like me. He was this crazy, funny goofball who did these randomly impulsive things, and he liked to make people smile and laugh, and he was just one of the greatest people ever.
One of the themes that runs through these interviews you've done, Ed, is that for the 9/11 kids, so Robin, for example, being who they are came with an extraordinary amount of pressure, like they were cast as characters in a play that others had written for them. And I'm wondering if there was anything in the prevailing national mood that they did relate to, that they felt did echo the way that they felt.
Robin described to me having spent the last 2 decades in a complete blackout. She will not listen to the news. She will have nothing to do with it. And when I asked her about the events in Afghanistan, she said, well, I don't know anything about that at all.
I didn't even know about that. I'm being 100% honest.
Which bit of it you didn't know about?
The whole thing? Any of it. I don't watch the news. I don't read news articles on Facebook. I stay out of the news because it physically repulses me.
But there was one event that, for her, pierced through this news blackout and was also incredibly important for Mike and Dan.
The United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
Celebrations in the United States. The pictures say it all. Americans celebrating the news that bin Laden has been killed.
Robin in particular describes it was on Amanda's birthday. I think she was 14. And they were having a cake for Amanda's birthday. And when the news came through, they turned that cake into a celebration of the death of Osama bin Laden.
Well, this is going to make us sound really horrible because we're not... we celebrated, like, in our own weird way.
What kind of cake?
It was chocolate ice cream cake. It was really good.
I think it was an elation partly of feelings of vengeance that they got him, but also a feeling slightly of closure and of justice that their father's killer was now himself dead.
Coming up, how these families will spend Saturday, the 20th anniversary of the attacks. It's 20 years on now from those attacks, and there's a feeling in some ways that the era that 9/11 started has now ended. You know, the war in Afghanistan just wrapped up for the Americans and coalition troops anyway, and COVID-19 has pushed terrorism down the list of priorities, perhaps temporarily. At this point, on this anniversary, where do Robin and her family and the twins, Dan and Mike, find themselves?
Yeah, I think there's very little sense of being able to move on from 9/11 if you're a 9/11 child, partly because media won't allow you to, but also partly because over the years it has entered into their identity. And in the twins' case, that's the clearest because they've actually set up a company called Tall Order, and it sells socks for tall people like themselves. The idea of socks came from when their mother, post-9/11, used to take them down to Ground Zero, and they would hand out food and drink to the first responders working on the pile. And they started giving them socks because their socks would get very wet. And so they give them dry socks. And that's where that idea came from. They've done it in honor of the father they lost. And some of the profits that they make go to Tuesday's Children, the group that works with 9/11 kids. They also describe to me how they're now working with other families who have been through trauma and grief involving children. It could be parents who've died as a result of mass shootings in America or other terrorist events around the world, to try and help healing and to offer their own comfort and advice, having been through what they've been through. And so even in their adult lives, in their adult work, 9/11 is front and center of what they do now. As for Robin, her father, Robbie, was 29 when he died. And she's starting to kind of get a little bit concerned that when she turns 20, she'll now be within spitting distance of being the age of her father when he died. And that has thrown up lots of thoughts. She's starting to think, well, soon she'll be doing things that her father was never able to do because he didn't live long enough. For instance, taking her own child, if she has one, to kindergarten, which he was never able to do with her. So she's having all these sort of very evocative thoughts about her own age as she grows and how it kind of dovetails with the father that she lost.
We're coming up, as you say, on the 20th anniversary of their loss. What will the kids be doing on September 11 this year?
The twins are planning to do what they do every year, which is to go to Peter Luger's Steakhouse in Brooklyn, which all New Yorkers know well. It serves up huge slabs of steak, and they take with them the closest friends of their father and treat them to a steak dinner. And then the day after, they'll be going to the Giants game in honor of their father. For Robin and her mother, Vicky, and sister, Amanda, this is going to be a very special year because for the very first time, they are going to be attending the main memorial service, which is at Ground Zero in downtown Manhattan. And Robin and Amanda have put in to be one of the people who read out the names of those who died.
Jonathan Neff Capello.
I've been to several of those memorial occasions myself. Even years after, they're very, very emotional and difficult. Just to hear the names being read over several hours is extraordinarily distressing.
Carlino, Michael Scott Carlo, and my father and guardian angel, Cesar Amaranto Alvar. We miss you and love you always.
And you're sitting there right in front of the memorial pools, which are in the footprint of the two twin towers. And for the first time, Vicky and the two girls have felt up to it to actually go and attend the main service. So that's going to be a big deal for them.
This 20th anniversary is a moment for everybody to reflect on the attacks and on the way that they shaped the world. For the kids you've been talking to, for Robin, for the twins, Dan and Mike, how do they understand the impact of this event on their own lives?
For Dan and Mike, they're quite clear about this. Let's not get it wrong. They don't want 9/11 to have happened. They want their father back. They're very, very clear about that. But having said that, they think they grew up quicker. They think they grew up stronger. They think they've become a better version of themselves. Perhaps that's the way to put it.
When you lose a parent in a very traumatic way, that's really the tough times, and that's what really tests you. How you do on a test, how you do in athletics, whether you're good or bad, at the end of the day, that's not going to define who you are. It's how you bounce back from the really difficult situations. And as kids, you don't necessarily get that perspective, and we had to learn that perspective very, very quickly.
It made us grow up faster than most people, and it's helped us to where we are today.
I think in Robin's case, she's extremely proud that she has become an independent, strong woman, able to stand on her own two feet. She's now at college. She's living with her boyfriend away from her mother. And she really sees herself as someone who has overcome adversity and emerged stronger for it.
I'm insanely surprised of how good I turned out because there's been so much up against me.
And her only regret was that her father was not able to see. It was interesting the way she put it, I thought. She didn't say she wasn't able to hear her father say how proud he was of her. She said she regretted that her father wasn't able
he
to see
how proud I am just of myself.
So that's how the event has shaped their lives, the story they tell themselves about 9/11. But I can imagine having heard them speak and having spoken to you, that when that anniversary comes, mixed in with all of that is just going to be this sense of loss of an individual person, their fathers, who left home that morning and didn't come back.
Absolutely. It's going to be a personal day. It's going to be about them and the fathers they lost. And it's interesting, they have slightly different takes on this. For Robin, who never knew her father, I think the emotion that is dominant and will be dominant on the day itself for the 20th anniversary is one of regret. Is having learnt that story that he came so close to stepping into the elevator, one of the last elevators down to the ground floor and to safety, but decided not to get in it because he wanted to just check that none of his colleagues were still in danger. That preys on her mind a lot.
Yes, he was a hero, and I love that, but I do have moments where I get a little mad that he didn't just go into that elevator.
The twins, Mike and Dan, though they knew their father for 11 years and were intimately close to Andrew, the way they put it is that he's never left them. Mike described to me that when he's feeling a bit depressed, all he has to do is look at the photo of his father and he immediately feels better. He's a presence in their life.
He's with us every day because when we're down, he lifts us up. When we're having a hard time with work, he keeps helping us to push through. That's his presence. That's what he does.
Yeah, people on the internet will love to write, never forget. For us, we never actually forget.
Ed Pilkington, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Ed Pilkington, chief reporter for Guardian US. You can read all our September 11 anniversary coverage at theguardian.com. Tomorrow, we look at the perpetrators of the attack, Al-Qaeda, who pulled off the most consequential terrorist act of the modern era and were very nearly destroyed by it. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef, sound design by Axel Kakoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. Back Thursday.